This is a download from the Post Keynesian Economics Study Group, PKSG. For more information and terms of use, please visit www.postkeynesian.net.
Hello, my name is Mark Hayes, and welcome to the Keynes Seminar at Robinson College, Cambridge. On the 15th of March 2011, our first speaker was Professor Roy Rothheim of Skidmore College, New York State, who discussed Keynes's treatment of individual behaviour and economic equilibrium in the general theory, with responses from Dr. Stephen Pratton of King's College London and myself. You can download slides to accompany the talk from the PKSG website. Enjoy listening.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks for coming. I've been doing this a long time. And one of the things I always find interesting in studying the general theory and in thinking about it as not only a work in method but also work in political economy is the impact it's had, how it helps policymakers think about things, and how we think about it. All of those have been pretty disappointing, as you all know. I happened also to teach macroeconomic theory. And when one teaches macroeconomic theory, particularly in a community, there's the expectation that you will adhere to certain rules and regulations and teach certain things and do it without biting your lip or banging your head against the wall or asking yourself the question, why am I doing this? And so when I teach what is considered to be conventional mainstream macroeconomics, of course, what's lurking in the back of my mind is Keynes just shaking his head saying, what are you saying? What are you saying? What are you saying? And so this has always created a bit of a problem for me. I do the best I can. Tonight, what I want to focus on are a couple of things. I want to focus on a little snippet from, in fact, the preface to the general theory. I teach the history of economic thought, and one of the things that I always find is that when I ask students, I'll say, read the first couple of chapters of Ricardo, they never read the introduction. Read the first couple of chapters of Capital. They never read the introduction or the preface. It's as if, well, I should start at chapter one. Well, I'm going to start with the preface. In fact, I'm never going to get out of the preface for a while. And because, in fact, when one writes a preface, one is actually writing, in a way, in retrospect. You don't write your preface first. You write it last. And so Keynes had some time to think about what he was writing. And when he wrote the preface, he tried to convey to the reader what exactly was on his mind. Interestingly enough, what I find in the preface are questions that are not addressed. And so I want you to just keep in the back of your mind, or maybe in the forefront of your mind, two quotes, one from the preface and actually the other from Tony Lawson's 1997 book. Okay, well, here's the one from Keynes. You've actually probably seen it a lot, except I want to, in terms of figure and ground, make sure that something stands out, and so I've italicized it. This book has evolved into what is primarily a study of the forces which determine changes in the scale of output and employment as a whole. A monetary economy, we shall find, is essentially one in which changing views about the future are capable of influencing the quantity of employment and not merely its direction. That's the phrase I want you to be thinking about. That last one. Because it's essential to the point he's trying to make in the general theory. And it's not something about which one often reads. The second, which has had a profound influence on me, is this little quote from Tony's book, Choice Presupposes That the World Is Open. And actual events need not have been. Now, I do not want to give a lecture tonight which says, oh, if only Keynes had read Tony Lawson, then everything would have changed. In fact, David Lodge has a cute little thing on that, which I won't go into, about somebody who wrote his doctoral dissertation which was called The Influence of T.S. Eliot on William Shakespeare. But I do at least want to say that the research program and the direction of critical realism has, in fact, a lot in common with what Keynes had on his mind when he was trying to think through this question about the quantity of employment and not merely its direction. Okay, so let's begin with the conventional wisdom of unemployment, which is what I have to teach every day, and about which you're probably most familiar. And in fact, again, let's take those two phrases from the preface. One about the direction of employment, the second about the quantity of employment. Okay? Now, the direction of employment. Well, that's the one with which we're actually most comfortable, which is, think about a situation where you have two goods and where we always begin in equilibrium, and that's another lecture sometime. Why do we always begin with even in the, Eden and then have a fall from grace and hope that someday we'll get back to it? But we begin in equilibrium, and there's always the assumption that there's some type of random exogenous shock to this system, a change in technology, a change in tastes, that somehow will cause some worker who had a job to lose her job. But the way it's thought through is that must imply that somewhere else in our universe there is some industry in which there is an excess demand for labor. And so that unemployment, therefore, is just structural. That in fact, there is a temporary mismatch caused by an exogenous shock between somebody who had a job and who has lost the job and now needs to find another one. And so, Charles Plosser, no slouch in economics, one of the founders of real business cycle theory, was interviewed by the Wall Street Journal, and you can read as well as I can. You can't change the carpenter into a nurse easily, and you can't change the mortgage broker into a computer expert in a manufacturing plant very easily. Eventually, that stuff will sort itself out, and that's the issue, okay? And what's on my mind is how we think about the problem, because that's what was on Keynes's mind, how we think about the problem. And that's how they think about the problem, okay? You have two labor markets, not one, in two commodities, whether it's mortgage brokers and computer experts, whether it's manufacturers or nurses or whomever, okay? And that's how one thinks about it. And what's happened is that that's caused a revival of the beverage curve going way back to 1909, where now we think about the relationship between job vacancies and the number of unemployed workers, and a lot of the research that's coming out of a lot of the Federal Reserve banks in the U.S. Are all kind of trying to estimate beverage curves and scratching their heads because it's shifting. That is, the data doesn't conform the traditional beverage curve, and so that must mean the theory is fine and everything's fine. There's just a shift in the curve. I thought you might find it interesting what Keynes had to say to Beveridge after Beveridge read the general theory and wrote to his comments to Keynes. Keynes said this: "I'm grateful to you for sending your criticism of my book. General nature of your points is to such a convincement that I have really had a total failure in my attempt to convey to you what I'm driving at." And interestingly, if anyone framed the way the discipline thought about and thinks about unemployment in terms of the structuralist approach, it was Beveridge. He doesn't get the credit. He never got the credit that he deserved, and now he's getting perhaps too much of the credit. Okay. The second type of unemployment is normally referred to as Keynesian unemployment. Now, instead of thinking of different labor markets, the labor market for the computer software technician or the nurse or the construction worker, etc., now we somehow, without taking a breath, speak of something called the labor market. Now, the labor market perceptually, it's exactly like a labor market. It has a supply curve, it has a demand curve, they're independent, they are both mediated by a real wage. And so the Keynesian approach, as it is called, which of course really comes from Hicks, okay? And not only ISLM, by the way, but also his 1933 theory of wages, talks about the existence of and the mediation or remediation of unemployment in terms of this thing called the labor market. And it's very important that in the first case, in the structuralist sense, we have the indefinite article of a labor market. In the second case, we have the definite article of the labor market. Okay? And so simply, it's a matter of a disequilibrium that needs to be resolved. Now, the difference in approach is, oh, and I have a nice quote from Alan Blinder, okay, who basically says, in fact, Keynesians typically see unemployment as both too high on average and too variable, although they know that rigorous theoretical justification for these positions is hard to come by. I always find statements like that interesting. And we know it, we believe it, except we just can't really explain why. But again, it has to do with this belief that prices adjust only gradually. And of course, nobody ever asks the question, what prices? We don't ask questions like that. We get comfortable with a way of thinking. And therefore, if somebody says, take that way of thinking and put it into a different realm, now think that way, your neural passages have so been pruned that you can immediately think of something which is unthinkable about, don't end sentences with prepositions, and never blink. Okay? And that's where I'm going with all of that. Theoretical justification, of course, we now have as a basis for dynamic stochastic general equilibrium models. Nothing much has changed, in fact. In the long run, the future is conflated to the present. Okay, we assume there are probability distributions of the future, and of course we assume complete markets. In the short run, however, there may be frictions, there may be asymmetries in information, there may be frictions, you know all of those stories. But we know it's all going to get resolved by the end of the story. Okay? That's where we are. Now, policy, well, we know that one too. I didn't mean that for it to be blank, but that's very telling. Twice. The structuralist, of course, as you can imagine, what we need to do is provide better information, subsidize retraining, location, etc., for the individual to make free labor market supply decisions. You see, this is a choice-based notion. That's why we think of different markets. And the person who gets displaced because she builds houses because there's been a crash in the housing market, must make the choice. I'm going to have to find something else to do. And when she decides to get the information, when she decides to get the training, when she decides to pack up and move, then and only then will she have another job. But that job is waiting for her. Okay? So clearly all we need to do is to grease the wheels a little bit, and her life will be a lot better. No monetary and fiscal policies, obviously, because these are individual issues. And there's a state should never intervene in things that have anything to do with the individual. In the case of the so-called Keynesians, it becomes much more interesting, because these are the people who do advocate policy intervention, except they advocate policy intervention for a very curious reason, which is they will begin talking about a fall in aggregate demand. But then they will say, but one would expect that the labor market, don't ask what that means, will, under normal circumstances, resolve itself so that full employment will be restored eventually. But as we know, we have the goods market. I don't mean a market in houses. I don't mean a market in healthcare. I mean the goods market, which is mediated by the price level. We have a capital market. That one's a little complicated, but we have savings. We have investment mediated by a real rate of interest, a loanable funds market, as second once removed. And of course, we have the labor market. And problem is that, oh, we have menu prices and we have asymmetric information in borrowers and lenders, which cause there to be credit rationing. And of course, we have efficiency wages and insider outsiders and hysteresis, etc., all of which prevent those prices from falling. And because of that, it's possible for markets just to stick and thus necessitating state intervention. So the reason for the state intervention is because the markets don't work. So, three things to think about: individual choice, disequilibrium, and distribution, either within a or the labor market. And that's the conventional wisdom. That's the way we think about unemployment. Now, I think I've already talked about all of that, so I don't need to go through that, okay? And again, full employment, all potential workers will be employed in either of those cases, so long as the wage at which they're willing to offer labor services is equal to the value of the marginal product. And of course, that just rolls up our tongue, whether it's in a labor market, whether it's in the labor market. Okay, and that's very important. Now, disequilibrium and distribution, at the end of the day, after you go through all of the search costs and all of the problems, when we draw the pictures, when we write out the equations, what it really means is that somebody's going to have to take a cut and pay. And whether that's the person who was building houses, or whether that's, I don't know, the person in the labor market, somebody's going to have to take a cut in wages. Okay, so what it's really saying is, in very traditional Ricardian sense, is that the only way you're going to get this machine going is to get the income away from the workers and to the people who hire those workers so that they can be happy enough so that they'll start hiring back the workers again. And that is an underlying mechanism to either of these approaches. Okay, I threw this in just because I threw it in. I think you'll love seeing it. And this is very important just as a commentary on what the mainstream thinks about, you were asking the question about paradigm change. Oh, you were asking the question about paradigm changes. That's what the mainstream thinks about paradigm changes. Recessions are periods when households dislike working. I love that one. I thought it was when households dislike not eating. When households reduce their labor supply to drive up wages, I'm actually have my students now going. They have a project. They're going to have to go over to the unemployment office and interview workers and ask them how they are they really trying to withhold their labor from the market so that they can drive up wages. I think that might be an interesting project. But in fact, that's the conventional wisdom. Okay, this is where the state of macroeconomic is right now in terms of that question. Okay, well, the thing is that Keynes found all of those explanations illogical, and that's where this is going. It's that not that he found them politically offensive or anything, but he found them illogical, especially the second one, that one can think in terms of the labor market, talking about changes in the level of employment. And he said, sorry, it's illogical. There's no logic to this at all. That is, what you think you're talking about, you can't talk about. And because you can't talk about it, what are you doing? In fact, going through the general theory, what he says is the only way one can even understand the way we think about this thing in terms of the individual firm is if we assume that every other firm in the economy, and therefore the economy, is such that neither output nor employment changes. So you're going to have to assume that output and employment doesn't change in order to ask the question, what happens if output and employment changes? Okay, so that's illogical. You can't do that. So here we have a school of thought which tries to explain unemployment in a way that you can't explain it, except when you assume that there is none. And he found that confounding. And so if you look at this, to try to open it up a little bit, one could say that labor would be hired so long as the value of its marginal product, the extra output sold by employing workers at a known price of that product, equals its wage. That's what has to be presumed in order for you to even talk about this at all. You have to know that you're going to sell the output, and you have to know the price at which it's going to be sold. In fact, something that does not appear in the literature, and I find it interesting, is that when Pigou's theory of unemployment comes out, I should say, by the way, as a footnote, the second variant. That I was talking about before can be found perfectly in Pigou's theory of unemployment, book Unemployment, in 1912, where he in fact talks about, he even uses the phrase involuntary unemployment, and he even talks about a fall in demand, saying, however, full employment is still an issue that we can only understand in terms of whether wages will fall. Okay. Now, when his book comes out in 1933, of course, Keynes is beside himself, except those who have nothing better to do in their lives but to read Pigou. If you read his Industrial Fluctuation in 1927, and then the second edition in 29, but already back from 1927, okay, he's already talking about all of these questions. But when he comes out with the theory of unemployment in 1933, okay, Keynes writes to Dennis Robertson. He's infuriated. This book is horrible. But one of the things he says that has never been picked up, it hasn't picked up by Michael Ambrosi, it hasn't been picked up by Anahid Aslan Begi, the people who write about Pigou, and not too many people do, because reading Pigou is difficult. So Keynes says, okay, when Pigou was talking about the real wage, what's in the denominator? And of course, what's in the denominator is the product price of the individual firm. Robertson doesn't pick up on that, and it's never pursued, okay? But what Keynes was trying to ask is that how does one go from the individual firm to all firms when it's the product price is the denominator of the product price, which is known, is in the denominator of the real wage. How do you go to this thing called the real wage in the labor market, what's in the denominator? And that was a question that Keynes wanted to understand, and of course there was no way of understanding it. Okay? So, had to be assumed, therefore, that money wages didn't affect the price index of wage goods, if you were going to think in terms of the labor market. But that can only occur if output and employment in the economy as a whole cannot change. And Keynes said it presumes full employment, or as critical realists would say, it presumes the existence of closure. The system is closed from the start. Okay. Because without that, you couldn't have that type of knowledge. And there's a hidden implication. It must be that no individual firm's actions can affect the material conditions experienced by any other firm or the outcomes of those firms' decisions. You have to assume atomism. Otherwise, you're going to have problems in terms of this question of what's in the denominator. And you're going to have problems in terms of, will my sales affect somebody else's sales? Will my sales affect somebody else's prices? And so in order for us to make that leap from the individual product price to all prices, we have to assume atomism as well as closure. Atomism and closure are presumed in the type of thinking that is revealed in this second type of unemployment. Okay. What that means is, and this is where I think Tony has done a very nice job of describing the difference between this perception of choice that we all talk about and real choice. In a closed model where there's atomism, yes, on paper things happen, but no one had a choice. Because to have a choice means you could have chosen something else. And in this closed model, you cannot. And so, therefore, as we start to think about this, we're realizing that Keynes is criticizing the ontology of this method of understanding unemployment by saying that we have individuals, but they're attenuated stick figures. They could not have done anything else. They only have one, call it an option. It's not even an option. And that allows for us to then take this conceptualization of the individual firm and somehow, if you don't ask too many questions, flip it over to thinking about the economy as a whole. And this is the direction in which Keynes was starting to think. And as you read through his book in chapter 19, what he says is the only way we can define a demand curve for labor for a particular firm, where on the ordinate of, if a graph would be drawn, would be the real wage, where the denominator is the product price. It's the only way we can do that is if we assume that there is atomism and closure. In other words, if you only exist at a point and there is a confluence of a lot of factors that can be divided by each other and written down, but there's no life, there's no movement. And certainly the question of disequilibrium does not exist. You can't even ask the question, suppose there were a disequilibrium. In other words, what he was trying to say was there's no method by which they can even think about these problems. How's my time work?
About 13 minutes.
Okay. I have a very nice one from Vicky, but she heard it back and couldn't come, so I'll get through it quickly. This question about the non-existence of disequilibrium, Vicky Chick writes something very interesting. The conflict between this concept and Keynes' conception is a major source of the difficulty understanding Keynes today. There can be no meaning to disequilibrium in such a system, and I think it's very important. Okay. Okay. Now, so what do we have to do? And what did Keynes have to do? First, he had to transcend the conceptualization of an individual not being willing to work at a wage that would equal the value of her marginal product. That is, got to disabuse you of this way of thinking. Because so long as you continue to think this way, it's impossible to transcend that. And if you continue to think about this way, there's nothing you can think about. Okay, so that's the first thing you have to do. Get out of that mind frame. Okay? Transcend the idea of free choice when there is no free choice to be had, which is the consequence of the presumption of closure. Transcend the conceptualization of a labor market, both a and the labor market. If you talk about a labor market, the only way you can think about that is if you assume that output as a whole doesn't change, and it's just a matter of workers being displaced in one place, knowing perfectly well that there's an excess demand for labor somewhere else, or the labor market, which is simply illogical. So you have to transcend all of those things to start to understand where Keynes was coming from, okay? And what he wanted to do was he wanted to say, well, what about the possibility of involuntary unemployment? But as you see, each of these modes of thinking about unemployment, when you boil them down, are always choice-based. Well, what if unemployment is not choice-based? And that's what Keynes wanted to think about. Now, he has the first definition of unemployment, which is perhaps the most convoluted of all of them. Men are involuntarily unemployed if, in the event of a small rise in the price of wage goods relatively to the money wage. There's a reason for that. I won't go into it, why he thought about that. He's responding, believe it or not, to Pigou's industrial fluctuations in 1927. Okay, I mean, he's been thinking about this a long time. Okay, and just like the rest of us, when we write stuff, sometimes we pull stuff from earlier notes, and that's how he was thinking. But both the aggregate supply of labor willing to work for the current money wage, just can you hold that all in your mind, and the aggregate demand for it at that money wage would be greater than the existing volume of employment. Little somewhat incomprehensible. He tries again. He tries a number of times in the book, okay? I like this one better. Okay, for the mere existence of an insufficiency of effective demand, I'll get back to that in a minute, may and often will bring the increase of employment to a standstill before a level of full employment has been reached. The insufficiency of effective demand will inhibit the process of production, in spite of the fact that the marginal product of labor still exceeds in value the marginal disutility of employment. And I've bolded that. And that's what I want you to think about. What is he talking about? And I think I've figured it out. It's only taken 30 years. Okay? Mark Hayes... What?
No hope for me then.
Yeah. Well, when you turn 31, you'll figure it out. Mark paraphrases Keynes. Keynes doesn't quite say it this way, but I like the way Mark says it, so I'm quite sanguine about it. In a monetary production economy, labor cannot insist on being employed, even if its marginal revenue product and real wage exceed the marginal disutility of that amount of employment. What's he talking about? Keynes, not Mark. Okay? What's going on? Okay? In order to do that, we have to deconstruct it. I do not choose to hire labor. I'm a firm. Even if what I make currently by employing a worker is equal to what I pay them. That, I think, is what Keynes is saying. Now, why? Why would you not hire another worker if she's getting what she's worth? How do I know whether employing another worker will bring in enough revenue to cover her wage if I were to repeat the experiment? The assumption of atomism and closure implied that the firm will always be assured that the marginal value product of labor equals its wage, and therefore they can repeat the experiment, and they can do it over and over and over and over again. But in such a closed model, we cannot even think about the level of employment itself changing, so we can't even ask these questions. And if we start asking these questions, we need to be thinking about other things because this is not helpful, okay? And so therefore, the only way one can think about the question of involuntary unemployment is if you get rid of the assumptions of closure and atomism. Now, I'm not, by the way, footnote, saying that Keynes therefore was assuming imperfect competition. Atomism, imperfect competition is not the antithesis of atomism. Okay. That's very important. Fred, if Fred Lee were here, he'd be complaining now. Okay. And what Keynes was trying to get at, and there's a long history here about how Keynes thought about this, individuals must be socially constructed and recognize that they are socially constructed. See, both of those are important. It's not only that you are socially constructed, you have to know that you're socially constructed. Okay, and that your nature and understanding of their nature exists as a consequence of their actions in the context of others' actions. So it's not enough to be socially constructed, but say I'm an independent being. You have to recognize that my actions affect and are affected by what other people do. Okay, and that was something that Keynes was saying, the assumption of atomism doesn't adhere to. Well, if we're going to have to get rid of the assumptions of closure and atomism, then we're going to have to start thinking of the individual in a different way. And quoting from Tony, now, if the term social is to designate anything specific here, it must be a dependency on human intentional agency. And intentionality is very important here. In a closed system, there's no intentionality. There's passivity. I cannot know with any degree of certainty whether employing another worker will bring in enough revenue to cover her wage if I were to repeat the experiment. Why? Well, that makes sense if I'm a socially contextual individual. Because now I don't look inside myself. I don't look inside my production process to learn everything I need to learn in order to find out whether or not I am going to be successful by hiring that worker. I now have to say, if I hire one more worker, will I sell those goods? If events are the outcomes of systems that are open, if, in Tony's sense, intrinsic closure is violated, then it's impossible for any firm to be assured that the outcome they just experienced will repeat itself if they engage labor in exactly the same way as they just did. Current income transcending atomism and closure is not a reliable indicator of what the future will bring if I were to repeat my production plans. A concurrent events cannot assure a constant conjunction of events. Choice presupposes, this is what I wanted you to think about at the beginning. Choice presupposes that the world is open and actual events need not have been. And Keynes made intentional, purposeful choice by a socially constructed individual to stand at the focus of his analysis. Just because something occurred does not mean that it will occur again. I already said that. Okay. Now, go back to the thing I had you think about in the beginning. Except now I'm going to bold something I didn't bold before. This book has evolved into what is primarily a study of the forces which determine changes in the scale of output and employment and monetary economy. We shall find it's essentially one in which changing views about the future, okay, in terms of figure and ground, bring that to the forefront, are capable of influencing the quantity of employment and not merely its direction. The concept of changing views about the future are meaningless in a closed and atomistic system. All you need to know is the marginal product of labor and the marginal product of capital in order to find out exactly what to do. But in a socially contextual world where the individuals are social individuals, socially constructed individuals, then suddenly I cannot be sure what the results of my actions are going to be. And therefore the future becomes uncertain, as the word goes, because of the organic interdependence among all of the individuals in the act of making decisions. And so if we want to understand how the level of employment changes, we're going to have to think about the fact that there is a socially constructed individual who interacts with other individuals, and therefore she's going to have to think about the expectation of revenue, not just how much I can produce and therefore mechanically how much I'm going to sell. We have to transcend the atomism and we have to transcend the closure. How am I doing, Mark?
3 minutes.
3 minutes. Oh, can I buy another minute or so? Okay. And this is what Keynes was trying to talk about when he said our method of analyzing, you can read as well as I can, okay? He called his theory the theory of effective demand, and again, now suddenly we have a different individual here. And as soon as we have a different individual who is now thinking in terms of the expectation of revenue, recognizing that what she does is socially contextual, look at how he defines this. Sorry, I'm moving very quickly. Okay. The aggregate supply price of the output of a given output of employment is the expectation of proceeds, which will just make it worth the while of the entrepreneur to give the employment. Now when we think about employment, she has to think about the expectation of proceeds. That's different. Okay? Aggregate demands the proceeds which entrepreneurs expect to receive from the employment of so many people. Okay? So again, do you see this notion of the socially contextual individual standing at the very heart of this process? Okay, blah, 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 blah. Should I just tell the story from here and go on? Sure, why don't I do that? Okay, since I only have 2 minutes left, why don't I just continue the story? So as we look at the theory of effective demand, he's concerned about the expectation of revenue, And the expectation of revenue can come either from consumption demand or investment demand. He finds consumption demand to be relatively stable, and of course it's investment demand that is the thing that tends to be perfidious. And so what does he need to do? He needs to take this notion of the socially contextual individual. He needs to take this notion of an open system and redefine something which he calls the marginal efficiency of capital. In other words, what he says is that if we look at the prospective yield on a capital asset, on a durable good, which we will hire over a number of periods, I know I can buy a machine. I know that machine can produce so much output. I don't know whether I can sell that output. I don't know the price at which I can sell that output. I don't know what the cost would be of replacing that output. I don't know how many other firms are going to be doing that as well. I don't know how many firms in general are going to be producing and therefore increasing the aggregate demand of all products into which I can sell my products. I don't know any of those things. And that is the thing upon the basis upon which we have to think about each individual producer deciding whether she is going to hire so many workers. The slides go on to talk about short-term expectation, intermediate-term expectation. I love that one. He talks about that too. And long-term expectation, but that in fact, when we're talking about durable commodities, it is the long-term expectation which dominates the employment decision. And if the long-term expectation is based upon the organically interdependent uncertainty by which an investment is made, then to tie it all together very quickly, what is the possibility of involuntary unemployment? Well, that's very simple. That if every producer, to the best of her knowledge, looks ahead and says, I think this is all I can sell. This is my best guess of the prospective yield on capital assets, and these are how many workers I'm going to employ. If that happens across the economy, that's going to be the quantity of employment that will be occurring. And no producer is going to be compelled to hire another worker if she's told this worker will work for $1 an hour less. Wrong mind frame. That mind frame requires you to think in closed system and atomism. Thinking outside of that realm allows you to think about the possibility of a conjunction of events that could be persistent, which he called involuntary unemployment. Now, last point. So what happened? Well, as soon as the book comes out, as we know from Warren Young, John Hicks, Roy Harrod, James Mead, sit down in a room somewhere, look over each other's shoulders. According to Warren, Hicks looked over their shoulders more than looked over his. And each of them came up with what became the ISLM model. Hicks sends a draft to Keynes. Keynes writes back. Very politely. I found it very interesting. I really have next to nothing to say about way of criticism. However, okay, you make investment be a function of current income. I don't do that. I make it a function of expected income. Why is that so important? Because if each firm bases its investment decision on current income, then in fact, knowledge of results is the only basis upon which all other decisions will be made. It denies the possibility of anything other than atomism. Roy Harrod sends his piece. Oh, by the way, Hicks says I disagree with you. Roy Harrod sends his piece, Mr. Keynes, in Traditional Theory, to Keynes. Keynes says, I like your paper more than I can say. My God, I have to give a paper somewhere else. I wish I could just read yours instead. Oh, by the way, you don't mention effective demand. Or more precisely, the demand schedule for output as a whole. Okay? In other words, you missed my whole point. And because you missed my whole point, and because Hicks missed my whole point, you can't talk about the things you want to talk about. There's no such thing as a labor market. There's no such thing as the labor market. You cannot talk about changes in employment as a whole. And so the concluding remarks are simply that statement. We're back to where we started.
Thank you.
And that's it.
5 minutes.
Good.
Fine. You're very patient with me. Thank you very much indeed. So if I could ask Steve to give up the first part of our response.
Sure. Thanks, Roy. Thanks for the talk and for the paper. I've got 3 points I'd like to make, really. The first one is just how welcome I find Roy's overall project here. Roy, I think, is emphasising the importance of highlighting Keynes's ontological commitments, both for understanding Keynes's substantive contributions and also for understanding Keynes's relevance for us today, it seems to me. And I think he's absolutely right there. I think that what Roy shows, both in this paper and in previous publications indeed, is that Keynes has a very sophisticated ontological position. It's an ontological position that emphasises process, that emphasises structure, and yet still has a place for real human agency. And what Roy is insisting upon is that understanding Keynes's ontological commitments is crucial when understanding his substantive contributions to economic theory. And I think that's very important. I also think, you know, by extension, that this kind of ontological angle on Keynes is very useful in trying to assess Keynes's relevance for us today. So in terms of thinking about what's characteristic, for example, of post-Keynesian economics, it's only once you've really understood Keynes's ontological commitments that one can start to make sense of what is key to post-Keynesian economics and what differentiates post-Keynesian economics from, for example, the mainstream, but also perhaps what distinguishes post-Keynesian economics from other heterodox traditions in economics. So, I mean, I think that that Roy's strategy here is an incredibly significant one, and it highlights both how we should be understanding Keynes's contributions and what Keynes's contributions, what relevance they have for us today. The second point I have relates to the idea of equilibrium. This is particularly strong in the paper, but it's also referred to in Roy's talk. Okay. As I understand what Roy is saying, he's suggesting that there are two senses of equilibrium. So on the one hand, you have equilibrium linked very tightly to a closed system approach. And Roy is suggesting that that kind of approach to equilibrium can be found in axiomatic theorising of the type Valrar and others were engaged in, but it can also be found in some of Keynes's Cambridge colleagues at the time. So there's a specific approach to equilibrium associated with closed systems approaches that carry all sorts of ontological baggage with it, atomism and so on. And then what Roy does is to contrast that, I think, referring in part to Vicky Chick's work, contrasts that with an equilibrium approach associated with Keynes. So what Roy is suggesting is that the category of equilibrium is retained in Keynes, but the approach to equilibrium theorizing that one sees in the general theory is consistent with a very different kind of ontology, an ontology of open systems, of process, of fundamental uncertainty, and so on. Okay, so that's an important part of the paper as I read it. What I was a little bit disappointed in not seeing was an engagement with a discussion about other types of equilibrium theorising. So critical realists, for example, when they approach debates about equilibrium theorising in economics, also often distinguish between different senses of equilibrium. And so there's a discussion about equilibrium as a feature of a model, and equilibrium as a feature of the social world that a theorist is attempting to explain. Okay, and I think that distinction between a theoretic notion of equilibrium and a ontological notion of equilibrium would actually be very useful in this context of discussing Keynes and his colleagues in Cambridge at the time. I think that it would be very useful to deploy that distinction when you address these debates about equilibrium theorising in Cambridge in the 1930s. I think, for example, it may well be that you can carefully draw a distinction between the kind of Valrasian axiomatic approaches to equilibrium theorising, and even the more conventional approaches to equilibrium theorising adopted by Keynes's colleagues in Cambridge, in the sense that my guess is that Cambridge, the Cambridge colleagues would have very much a ontic notion of equilibrium that they are primarily concerned with. Okay, and also I think it would be very interesting, you know, in the context of debates about equilibrium theorising within heterodox economics, because, you know, critical realists would often want to argue that not only do heterodox economists typically emphasise an ontic reading of equilibrium, but also over time, many heterodox figures, for example, Joan Robinson, would recognise a feeling of queasiness with the equilibrium concept and finally abandon it pretty much wholesale. And it would be interesting to situate Keynes in that kind of broader context. And the final point I add, and this relates much more to the paper rather than to the presentation, throughout the paper there's reference to mainstream economics, and so Keynes is counterposed to mainstream. And what struck me was that how ambiguous the term mainstream is in these kinds of history of economics discussions. Because at the moment, I think, we're perhaps moving towards a relatively clear understanding of what contemporary mainstream economics is about in terms of its essence, a kind of insistence upon deductivist mathematical modelling. But what was mainstream in the 1930s was probably not that. I mean, it may have been linked much more to a very substantive kind of theoretical position. But I think one has to take care in the way one uses the term mainstream when one's kind of elaborating these kind of history of thought accounts. Okay, so those were my initial thoughts.
Thank you very much, Stephen.
Okay, well, my go. Again, I've had the benefit, like Stephen, of reading a paper that Roy has been kind enough to circulate, though it's a very rough draft, he says, though I thought it was rather good. And he's captured it in the presentation. But some of the points I'm going to make are fairly fine. And I apologise in a way for being both chair and speaker, so you must keep me to time. So I hope I will be as self-disciplined as I have disciplined the others. So in reading Roy's paper, what I found was that it sought to apply the methodological and ontological insights of Victoria Chick, Sheila Dow, and Tony Lawson, among others, to post-Keynesian, and specifically to Keynes's economics. The core of the paper and the presentation, I think, is a linkage between expectation and what Roy calls in the paper conscious real choice. I support the attempt to make that application of ontological considerations, etc., and to some extent that linkage. But looking at this from the very narrow perspective of what Keynes's general theory, which is not the only way of doing economics, I think the further distinction needs to be made between short and long-term expectation, and indeed even the medium-term expectation, which you mentioned. It gets just one brief mention in the general theory. And in my view, Roy reads a degree of freedom of agency into Keynes's theory of effective demand, which isn't there, or at least it's not where he says it is. In fact, I think his paper continues the debate about the nature of the state of short-term expectation in which I engaged Victoria Chick in this seminar last year. And I'm so sorry that she can't be here today as she'd intended. So let me first emphasise the common ground between us. We agree that expectation determines employment and output, as the title of GT Chapter 5 states. It does not matter whether employers' expectations are fulfilled. However, in practice, expectations are based on realised results, and the stickiness of the wage unit lends stability to the system. But that has nothing to do with the failure of some labour market to clear.
Write that down, that's very important.
And in what I think is a particularly important point, whether you just touch on it, I think you could give more emphasis to it, is another point.
I can only write about that so many times, Mark.
Well, the point I'm going to come to is that you recognise Schraffer's critique of the interdependence of individual firms' supply decisions and the need for a solution to that. Although I do think that Keynes deals with it differently from the way you're proposing. So if I can return to the earlier debate with Vicky, the key difference is whether the state of short-term expectation is determinate in the sense of an equilibrium solution set. Roy follows Vicky's approach in which the short-term expectations, by which I mean the prices expected by competitive firms, Marshallian, in this approach, expectations are a matter of individual judgment, and in Roy's terms, they're therefore a matter of conscious real choice. Now, I argued before that this approach is fatal to the concept of competitive equilibrium, a conclusion which Vicky and I think Roy greet with equanimity. Their approach requires the adoption, instead of a concept of equilibrium to the extent that it's relevant at all, as a state of rest, of stability over time, where expectations are fulfilled. Now, I believe that this is inconsistent with Keynes's own claim to offer an equilibrium theory of employment at any time, since under Vicky and Roy's thesis, employment is likely to be in disequilibrium most, if not all, of the time. Their approach is also fatal to the idea of a functional relation between independent and dependent variables, which is the mechanical framework, which Roy tells us in his paper, that Keynes rejected. Yet Keynes writes precisely in these terms in chapter 18, and I do believe Roy's quotation, which you flashed before us, about the blind manipulation of models, is taken out of context, because Keynes is talking there about the interrelationships between the independent variables, of his model of effective demand, not the relation between the independent and dependent variables of the within the model itself. And it's hard to see, hard for me to see at any rate, what meaning can be given to his employment function if it's not in fact a functional relation. So I suggest that the realm of conscious free choice does not lie with the entrepreneur qua employer, but with the entrepreneur qua dealer or investor, and with the consumer. Keynes's theory of the firm is, I suggest, as closed as the classical. Conscious real choice enters mainly, I suggest, into the medium-term expectations of the dealer and into the long-term expectations of the investor. Indeed, both are types of investor. Dealers investing in stocks of liquid capital and rentiers and employers in fixed capital. In the face of uncertainty, individual investment decisions, including the decision not to invest and hold money, are inevitably a matter of real choice. I'll skip the bit about consumption because I must keep myself to time. So I would link, I think it's important though, so I would link conscious real choice in the general theory to the medium and longer term expectations of the investor and the consumer, which I could elaborate, and not to the theory of the firm, which I think you focused on. In fact, you go so far as to suggest that without conscious real choice, there are no sound theoretical grounds for the concept of underemployment equilibrium. And I smell a sort of latent classicism here, insofar as this statement could be read as suggesting that the problem is actually a coordination failure of the post-Valrasian type, rather than a matter of effective demand. And I can't believe that Roy is arguing that conscious real choice is the only source of uncertainty, although it may be one factor, of course. I would suggest that in Keynes's construction, at least, uncertainty arises only in the context of consumption and investment decisions, and it is uncertainty that opens up both the possibility and the necessity of conscious real choice. So finally, I would take very mild issue with Roy's opening claim that the classical theory cannot explain changes in aggregate output and employment. This may just be a question of clarification rather than fundamental difference. Because after all, classical theory from Pigou to Plosser all claim to model changes in aggregate output and employment. The difference is that they are all full employment models in Keynes's sense, and as you've pointed out, they are logically incapable of dealing with a monetary economy in which involuntary unemployment is possible. So maybe that's just a clarification. So in conclusion, I applaud the effort, but I think Roy has situated the openness of Keynes's system in the wrong place. I would argue that the general theory contains a model at its core. But the difference from classical theory is that in Keynes's system, there are independent variables with a life of their own, as well as parameters. So the propensity to consume, the marginal efficiency of capital, and liquidity preference are independent variables that can vary and are not, as in the classical system, themselves determined by endowment, technology and preferences. And I think that's where we find openness and the scope for conscious real choice.